alone. In Genoa, he received a letter from his friend Paul Ray, a Prussian philosopher whom he admired, recounting his discussions with a remarkable young Russian woman, Lou von Salome, in Rome. Salome was there on holiday with her mother. Ray had managed to accompany her on long walks through the city, unchaperoned, and they had had many conversations. Her ideas on God and Christianity were quite similar to Nietzsche's, and when Ray had told her that the famous philosopher was a friend of his, she had insisted that he invite Nietzsche to join them. In subsequent letters, Ray described how mysteriously captivating Salome was, and how anxious she was to meet Nietzsche. The philosopher soon went to Rome. When Nietzsche finally met Salome, he was overwhelmed. She had the most beautiful eyes he had ever seen, and during their first long talk, those eyes lit up so intensely that he couldn't help feeling there was something erotic about her excitement. Yet he was also confused. Salome kept her distance and didn't respond to his compliments. What a devilish young woman. A few days later, she read him a poem of hers, and he cried. Her ideas about life were so like his own. Deciding to seize the moment, Nietzsche proposed marriage. He did not know that Ray had done so as well. Salome declined. She was interested in philosophy, life, adventure, not marriage. Undaunted, Nietzsche continued to court her. On an excursion to Lake Orta with Ray, Salome, and her mother, he managed to get the girl alone, accompanying her on a walk up Monte Sacro while the others stayed behind. Apparently, the views and Nietzsche's words had the proper passionate effect. In a later letter to her, he described this walk as the most beautiful dream of my life. Now he was a man possessed. All he could think about was marrying Salome and having her all to himself. A few months later, Salome visited Nietzsche in Germany. They took long walks together and stayed up all night discussing philosophy. She mirrored his deepest thoughts, anticipated his ideas about religion. Yet when he again proposed marriage, she scolded him as conventional. It was Nietzsche, after all, who had developed a philosophical defense of the Superman, the man above everyday morality. Yet Salome was by nature far less conventional than he was. Her firm, uncompromising manner only deepened the spell she cast over him, as did her hint of cruelty. When she finally left him, making it clear that she had no intention of marrying him, Nietzsche was devastated. As an antidote to his pain, he wrote Thus Spake Zarathustra, a book full of sublimated eroticism and deeply inspired by his talks with her. From then on, Salome was known throughout Europe as the woman who had broken Nietzsche's heart. Salome moved to Berlin. Soon, the city's greatest intellectuals were falling under the spell of her independence and free spirit. The playwrights Gerhard Hauptmann and Frank Wedekind became infatuated with her. In 1897, the great Austrian poet Rainer Maria Rilke fell in love with her. By that time, her reputation was widely known, and she was a published novelist. This certainly played a part in seducing Rilke, but he was also attracted by a kind of masculine energy he found in her that he had never seen in a woman. Rilke was then 22, Salome 36. He wrote her love letters and poems, followed her everywhere, and began an affair with her that was to last several years. She corrected his poetry, imposed discipline on his overly romantic verse, inspired ideas for new poems. But she was put off by his childish dependence on her, his weakness. Unable to stand weakness of any kind, she eventually left him. Consumed by her memory, Rilke long continued to pursue her. In 1926, lying on his deathbed, he begged his doctors, "Ask Lou what is wrong with me. She's the only one who knows." One man wrote of Salome, "There was something terrifying about her embrace. Looking at you with her radiant blue eyes, she would say, 'The reception of the semen is for me the height of ecstasy.' And she had an insatiable appetite for it. She was completely amoral. A vampire. The Swedish psychotherapist, Paul Biera, one of her later conquests, wrote, I think Nietzsche was right when he said that Lou was a thoroughly evil woman. Evil, however, in the Goethean sense. Evil that produces good. She may have destroyed lives and marriages, but her presence was exciting. The two emotions that almost every male felt in the presence of Lou Andrea Salome were confusion and excitement, the two prerequisite feelings for any successful seduction. People were intoxicated by her strange mix of the masculine and the feminine. She was beautiful, with a radiant smile and a graceful, flirtatious manner, but her independence and her intensely analytical nature made her seem oddly male. This ambiguity was expressed in her eyes, which were both coquettish and probing. It was confusion that kept men interested and curious. No other woman was like this. They wanted to know more. The excitement stemmed from her ability to stir up repressed desires. She was a complete nonconformist, and to be involved with her was to break all kinds of taboos. Her masculinity made the relationship seem vaguely homosexual. Her slightly cruel, slightly domineering streak could stir up masochistic yearnings, as it did in Nietzsche. Salome radiated a forbidden sexuality. Her powerful effect on men, the lifelong infatuations, the suicides, there were several, the periods of intense creativity, the descriptions of her as a vampire or a devil, attest to the obscure depths of the psyche she was able to reach and disturb. The masculine dandy succeeds by reversing the normal pattern of male superiority in matters of love and seduction. A man's apparent independence, his capacity for detachment, often seems to give him the upper hand in the dynamic between men and women. A purely feminine woman will arouse desire but is always vulnerable to the man's capricious loss of interest. A purely masculine woman, on the other hand, will not arouse that interest at all. Follow the path of the masculine dandy, however, and you neutralize all a man's powers. Never give completely of yourself. While you are passionate and sexual, always retain an air of independence and self-possession. You might move on to the next man, or so he will think. You have other, more important matters to concern yourself with, such as your work. Men do not know how to fight women who use their own weapons against them. They are intrigued, aroused, and disarmed. Few men can resist the taboo pleasures offered up to them by the masculine dandy. Keys to the character. Many of us today imagine that sexual freedom has progressed in recent years, that everything has changed for better or worse. This is mostly an illusion. A reading of history reveals periods of licentiousness, Imperial Rome, late 17th century England, the floating world of 18th century Japan, far in excess of what we are currently experiencing. Gender roles are certainly changing, but they have changed before. Society is in a state of constant flux, but there is something that does not change. The vast majority of people conform to whatever is normal for the time. They play the role allotted to them. Conformity is a constant because humans are social creatures who are always imitating one another. At certain points in history, it may be fashionable to be different and rebellious, but if a lot of people are playing that role, there is nothing different or rebellious about it. We should never complain about most people's slavish conformity, however, for it offers untold possibilities of power and seduction to those who are up for a few risks. Dandies have existed in all ages and cultures. Alcibiades in ancient Greece, Koretchka in late 10th century Japan. And wherever they have gone, they have thrived on the conformist role-playing of others. The dandy displays a true and radical difference from other people, a difference of appearance and manner. Since most of us are secretly oppressed by our lack of freedom, we are drawn to those who are more fluid and flaunt their difference. Dandies seduce socially as well as sexually. Groups form around them. Their style is wildly imitated. An entire court or crowd will fall in love with them. In adapting the dandy character for your own purposes, remember that the dandy is by nature a rare and beautiful flower. Be different in ways that are both striking and aesthetic, never vulgar. Poke fun at current trends and styles, go in a novel direction, and be supremely uninterested in what anyone else is doing. Most people are insecure. They will wonder what you're up to, and slowly they will come to admire and imitate you because you express yourself with total confidence. The dandy has traditionally been defined by clothing, and certainly most dandies create a unique visual style. Beau Brummel, the most famous dandy of all, would spend hours on his toilette, particularly the inimitably styled knot in his necktie, for which he was famous throughout early 19th century England. But a dandy's style cannot be obvious, for dandies are subtle and never try hard for attention. Attention comes to them. The person whose clothes are fragrantly different has little imagination or taste. Dandies show their difference in the little touches that mark their disdain for convention. Théophile Gautier's red vest, Oscar Wilde's green velvet suit, Andy Warhol's silver wigs. The great English Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli had two magnificent canes, one for morning, one for evening. At noon, he would change canes, no matter where he was. The female dandy works similarly. She may adopt male clothing, say, but if she does, a touch here or there will set her truly apart. No man ever dressed quite like George Sand. The overtall hat, the riding boots worn on the streets of Paris, made her a sight to behold. Remember, there must be a reference point. If your visual style is totally unfamiliar, people will think you at best an obvious attention-getter, at worst, crazy. Instead, create your own fashion sense by adapting and altering prevailing styles to make yourself an object of fascination. Do this right, and you will be wildly imitated. The Count d'Orsay, a great London dandy of the 1830s and 1840s, was closely watched by fashionable people. One day, caught in a sudden London rainstorm, he bought a paltrok, a kind of heavy, hooded duffel coat off the back of a Dutch sailor. The paltrok immediately became the coat to wear. Having people imitate you, of course, is a sign of your powers of seduction. The nonconformity of dandies, however, goes far beyond appearances. It is an attitude towards life that sets them apart. Adopt that attitude, and a circle of followers will form around you. Dandies are supremely impudent. They don't give a damn about other people, and never try to please. In the court of Louis XIV, the writer, La Bruyère, noticed that courtiers who tried hard to please were invariably on the way down. Nothing was more anti-seductive. As Barbé d'Orvilly wrote, "Dandies please women by displeasing them." Impudence was fundamental to the appeal of Oscar Wilde. In a London theater one night, after the first performance of one of Wilde's plays, the ecstatic audience yelled for the author to appear on stage. Wilde made them wait and wait, and then finally emerged, smoking a cigarette and wearing an expression of total disdain. "It may be bad manners to appear here smoking, but it is far worse to disturb me when I am smoking," he scolded his fans. The Count d'Orsay was equally impudent. At a London club one night, a Rothschild, who was notoriously cheap, accidentally dropped a gold coin on the floor, then bent down to look for it. The Count immediately whipped out a 1,000-franc note, worth much more than the coin, rolled it up, lit it like a candle, and got down on all fours, as if to help light the way in the search. Only a dandy could get away with such audacity. The insolence of the rake is tied up with his desire to conquer a woman. He cares for nothing else. The insolence of the dandy, on the other hand, is aimed at society and its conventions. It's not a woman he cares to conquer, but a whole group, an entire social world. And since people are generally oppressed by the obligation of always being polite and self-sacrificing, they are delighted to spend time around a person who disdains such niceties. Dandies are masters of the art of living. They live for pleasure, not for work. They surround themselves with beautiful objects and eat and drink with the same relish they show for their clothes. This was how the great Roman writer Petronius, author of the Satyricon, was able to seduce the emperor Nero. Unlike the dull Seneca, the great Stoic thinker and Nero's tutor, Petronius knew how to make every detail of life a grand aesthetic adventure, from a feast to a simple conversation. This is not an attitude you should impose on those around you. You can't make yourself a nuisance. But if you simply seem socially confident and sure of your taste, people will be drawn to you. The key is to make everything an aesthetic choice. Your ability to alleviate boredom by making life an art will make your company highly prized. The opposite sex is a strange country we can never know, and this excites us, creates the proper sexual tension. But it is also a source of annoyance and frustration. Men don't understand how women think, and vice versa. Each tries to make the other act more like a member of their own sex. Dandies may never try to please, but in this one area, they have a pleasing effect. By adopting psychological traits of the opposite sex, they appeal to our inherent narcissism. Women identified with Rudolph Valentino's delicacy and attention to detail in courtship. Men identified with Lou Andrea Salome's lack of interest in commitment. In the Heian court of 11th century Japan, Sei Shonagon, the writer of the Pillow Book, was powerfully seductive for men, especially literary types. She was fiercely independent, wrote poetry with the best, and had a certain emotional distance. Men wanted more from her than just to be her friend or companion. As if she were another man, charmed by her empathy for male psychology, they fell in love with her. This kind of mental transvestism, the ability to enter the spirit of the opposite sex, adapt to their way of thinking, mirror their tastes and attitudes, can be a key element in seduction. It is a way of mesmerizing your victim. According to Freud, the human libido is essentially bisexual. Most people are in some way attracted to people of their own sex, but social constraints, varying with culture and historical period, repress these impulses. The dandy represents a release from such constraints. In several of Shakespeare's plays, a young girl, back then the female roles in the theater were actually played by male actors, has to go into disguise and dresses up as a boy, eliciting all kinds of sexual interest from men, who later are delighted to find out that the boy is actually a girl. Think, for example, of Rosalind in As You Like It. Entertainers such as Josephine Baker, known as the Chocolate Dandy, and Marlene Dietrich would dress up as men in their acts, making themselves wildly popular among men. Meanwhile, the slightly feminized male, the pretty boy, has always been seductive to women. Valentino embodied this quality. Elvis Presley had feminine features, the face, the hips, wore frilly pink shirts and eye makeup, and attracted the attention of women early on. The filmmaker Kenneth Anger said of Mick Jagger that it was a bisexual charm which constituted an important part of the attraction he had over young girls, and which acted upon their unconscious. In Western culture, for centuries, in fact, feminine beauty has been far more fetishized than male beauty, so it is understandable that a feminine-looking face like that of Montgomery Clift would have more seductive power than that of John Wayne. The dandy figure has a place in politics as well. John F. Kennedy was a strange mix of the masculine and feminine, virile in his toughness with the Russians and in his White House lawn football games, yet feminine in his graceful and dapper appearance. This ambiguity was a large part of his appeal. Disraeli was an incorrigible dandy in dress and manner. Some were suspicious of him as a result, but his courage in not caring what people thought of him also won him respect. And women, of course, adored him, for women always adore a dandy. They appreciated the gentleness of his manner, his aesthetic sense, his love of clothes, in other words, his feminine qualities. The mainstay of Disraeli's power was, in fact, a female fan, Queen Victoria. Do not be misled by the surface disapproval your dandy pose may elicit. Society may publicize its distrust of androgyny. In Christian theology, Satan is often represented as androgynous. But this conceals its fascination. What is most seductive is often what is most repressed. Learn a playful dandyism, and you will become the magnet for people's dark, unrealized yearnings. The key to such power is ambiguity. In a society where the roles everyone plays are obvious, the refusal to conform to any standard will excite interest. Be both masculine and feminine, impudent and charming, subtle and outrageous. Let other people worry about being socially acceptable. Those types are a dime a dozen, and you are after a power greater than they can imagine. Dangers. The dandy's strength, but also the dandy's problem, is that he or she often works through transgressive feelings relating to sex roles. Although this activity is highly charged and seductive, it is also dangerous, since it touches on a source of great anxiety and insecurity. The greater dangers will often come from your own sex. Valentino had immense appeal for women, but men hated him. He was constantly dogged with accusations of being perversely unmasculine, and this caused him great pain. Salome was equally disliked by women. Nietzsche's sister, and perhaps his closest friend, considered her an evil witch, and led a virulent campaign against her in the press long after the philosopher's death. There is little to be done in the face of resentment like this. Some dandies try to fight the image they themselves have created, but this is unwise. To prove his masculinity, Valentino would engage in a boxing match, anything to prove his masculinity. He wound up looking only desperate. Better to accept society's occasional jibes with grace and insolence. After all, the dandy's charm is that they don't really care what people think of them. That is how Andy Warhol played the game. When people tired of his antics or some scandal erupted, instead of trying to defend himself, he would simply move on to some new image, decadent bohemian, high society portraitist, etc. As if to say, with a hint of disdain, that the problem lay not with him, but with other people's attention span. Another danger for the dandy is the fact that insolence has its limits. Beau Brummel prided himself on two things, his trimness of figure and his acerbic wit. His main social patron was the Prince of Wales, who in later years grew plump. One night at dinner, the prince rang for the butler, and Brummel snidely remarked, "Do ring, Big Ben." The prince did not appreciate the joke, had Brummel shown out, and never spoke to him again. Without royal patronage, Brummel fell into poverty and madness. Even a dandy, then, must measure out his impudence. A true dandy knows the difference between a theatrically staged teasing of the powerful and a remark that will truly hurt, offend, or insult. It is particularly important to avoid insulting those in a position to injure you. In fact, the pose may work best for those who can afford to offend. Artists, bohemians, etc. In the work world, you will probably have to modify and tone down your dandy image. Be pleasantly different, an amusement, rather than a person who challenges the group's conventions and makes others feel insecure. In conclusion, here are some further reflections on the dandy. From Ovid's Metamorphoses. Once a son was born to Mercury and the goddess Venus, and he was brought up by the naiads in Ida's caves. In his features it was easy to trace resemblance to his father and to his mother. He was called after them too, for his name was Hermaphroditus. As soon as he was 15, he left his native hills and Ida, where he had been brought up, and for the sheer joy of traveling, visited remote places. He went as far as the cities of Lycia and on to the Carians, who dwell nearby. In this region he spied a pool of water, so clear that he could see right to the bottom. The water was like crystal, and the edges of the pool were ringed with fresh turf and grass that was always green. A nymph, Salmasis, dwelt there. Often she would gather flowers, and it so happened that she was engaged in this pastime when she caught sight of the boy, Hermaphroditus. As soon as she had seen him, she longed to possess him. She addressed him, "Fair boy, you surely deserve to be thought a god. If you are, perhaps you may be Cupid? If there is such a girl engaged to you, let me enjoy your love in secret, but if there is not, then I pray that I may be your bride, and that we may enter upon marriage together." The naiad said no more, but a blush stained the boy's cheeks, for he did not know what love was. Even blushing became him. His cheeks were the color of ripe apples, hanging in a sunny orchard, like painted ivory. Or like the moon when, in eclipse, she shows a reddish hue beneath her brightness. Incessantly the nymph demanded at least sisterly kisses, and tried to put her arms around his ivory neck. "Will you stop?" he cried, "or I shall run away and leave this place and you." Salmasis was afraid. "I yield the spot to you, stranger. I shall not intrude," she said, and turning from him, pretended to go away. The boy, meanwhile, thinking himself unobserved and alone, strolled this way and that on the grassy sward, and dipped his toes in the lapping water. Then his feet up to the ankles. Then, tempted by the enticing coolness of the waters, he quickly stripped his young body of its soft garments. At the sight, Salmasis was spellbound. She was on fire with passion to possess his naked beauty, and her very eyes flamed with a brilliance like that of the dazzling sun when his bright disk is reflected in a mirror. She longed to embrace him then, and with difficulty restrained her frenzy. Hermaphroditus, clapping his hollow palms against his body, dived quickly into the stream. As he raised first one arm and then the other, his body gleamed in the clear water as if someone had encased an ivory statue or white lilies in transparent glass. "I have won! He is mine!" cried the nymph, and flinging aside her garments, plunged into the heart of the pool. The boy fought against her, but she held him and snatched kisses as he struggled, placing her hands beneath him, stroking his unwilling breast, and clinging to him, now on this side and now on that. Finally, in spite of all his efforts to slip from her grasp, she twined around him like a serpent when it is being carried off into the air by the king of birds, for as it hangs from the eagle's beak, the snake coils round his head and talons and with its tail hampers his beating wings. "You may fight, you rogue, but you will not escape. May the gods grant me this. May no time to come ever separate him from me or me from him." Her prayers found favor with the gods, for as they lay together their bodies were united, and from being two persons they became one. As when a gardener grafts a branch onto a tree and sees the two unite as they grow and come to maturity together, so when their limbs met in that clinging embrace, the nymph and the boy were no longer two, but a single form, possessed of a dual nature which could not be called male or female, but seemed to be at once both and neither. From Charles Baudelaire's The Dandy. Dandyism is not even, as many unthinking people seem to suppose, an immoderate interest in personal appearance and material elegance. For the true dandy, these things are only a symbol of the aristocratic superiority of his personality. What, then, is this ruling passion that has turned into a creed and created its own skilled tyrants? What is this unwritten constitution that has created so haughty a caste? It is, above all, a burning need to acquire originality within the apparent bounds of convention. It is a sort of cult of oneself, which can dispense even with what are commonly called illusions. It is the delight in causing astonishment, and the proud satisfaction of never oneself being astonished.
From Plutarch's The Life of Alcibiades. In the midst of this display of statesmanship, eloquence, cleverness, and exalted ambition, Alcibiades lived a life of prodigious luxury, drunkenness, debauchery, and insolence.
He was effeminate in his dress and would walk through the marketplace trailing his long purple robes, and he spent extravagantly. He had the decks of his triremes cut away to allow him to sleep more comfortably, and his bedding was slung on cords rather than spread on the hard planks. He had a golden shield made for him, which was emblazoned not with any ancestral device, but with the figure of Eros armed with a thunderbolt. The leading men of Athens watched all this with disgust and indignation, and they were deeply disturbed by his contemptuous and lawless behavior, which seemed to them monstrous and suggested the habits of a tyrant. The people's feelings towards him have been very aptly expressed by Aristophanes in the line, "They long for him, they hate him, they cannot do without him." The fact was that his voluntary donations, the public shows he supported, his unrivaled munificence to the state, the fame of his ancestry, the power of his oratory, and his physical strength and beauty, all combined to make the Athenians forgive him everything else, and they were constantly finding euphemisms for his lapses and putting them down to youthful high spirits and honorable ambition.
From Venus Castina by C.J. Bullitt.
Further light, a whole flood of it, is thrown upon this attraction of the male in petticoats for the female in the diary of the Abbé de Choisy, one of the most brilliant men-women of history, of whom we shall hear a great deal more later. The Abbé, a churchman of Paris, was a constant masquerader in female attire. He lived in the days of Louis XIV and was a great friend of Louis's brother, also addicted to women's clothes. A young girl, Mademoiselle Charlotte, thrown much into his company, fell desperately in love with the Abbé, and when the affair had progressed to a liaison, the Abbé asked her how she came to be won. She said, "I stood in no need of caution, as I should have with a man. I saw nothing but a beautiful woman. And why should I be forbidden to love you? What advantages a woman's dress gives you? The heart of a man is there, and that makes a great impression upon us. And on the other hand, all the charms of the fair sex fascinate us, and prevent us from taking precautions."
From The Game of Hearts, Harriet Wilson's Memoirs.
Beau Brummel was regarded as unbalanced in his passion for daily ablutions. His ritualistic morning toilet took upward of 5 hours, 1 hour spent inching himself into his skin-tight buckskin breeches, an hour with the hairdresser, and another 2 hours tying and creasing down a series of starched cravats until perfection was achieved. But first of all, 2 hours were spent scrubbing himself with fetish zeal from head to toe in milk, water, and eau de cologne. Beau Brummel said he used only the froth of champagne to polish his Hessian boots. He had 365 snuff boxes, those suitable for summer wear being quite unthinkable in winter, and the fit of his gloves was achieved by entrusting their cut to two firms, one for the fingers, the other for the thumbs. Sometimes, however, the tyranny of elegance became altogether insupportable. A Mr. Boothby committed suicide and left a note saying he could no longer endure the ennui of buttoning and unbuttoning. From Jules Lemaître's Les Contemporains. This royal manner which the dandy raises to the height of true royalty, the dandy has taken this from women, who alone seem naturally made for such a role. It is somewhat by using the manner and the method of women that the dandy dominates, and this usurpation of femininity. He makes women themselves approve of this. The dandy has something antinatural and androgynous about him, which is precisely how he is able to endlessly seduce. The Natural. Childhood is the golden paradise we are always consciously or unconsciously trying to recreate. The natural embodies the longed-for qualities of childhood: spontaneity, sincerity, unpretentiousness. In the presence of naturals, we feel at ease, caught up in their playful spirit, transported back to that golden age. Naturals also make a virtue out of weakness, eliciting our sympathy for their trials, making us want to protect them and help them. As with a child, much of this is natural, but some of it is exaggerated, a conscious, seductive maneuver. Adopt the pose of the natural to neutralize people's natural defensiveness and infect them with helpless delight. Psychological traits of the natural. Children are not as guileless as we like to imagine. They suffer from feelings of helplessness and sense early on the power of their natural charm to remedy their weakness in the adult world. They learn to play a game. If their natural innocence can persuade a parent to yield to their desires in one instance, then it is something they can use strategically in another instance, laying it on thick at the right moment to get their way. If their vulnerability and weakness is so attractive, then it is something they can use for effect. Why are we seduced by children's naturalness? First, because anything natural has an uncanny effect on us. Since the beginning of time, natural phenomena, such as lightning storms or eclipses, have instilled in human beings an awe tinged with fear. The more civilized we become, the greater the effect such natural events have on us. The modern world surrounds us with so much that is manufactured and artificial that something sudden and inexplicable fascinates us. Children also have this natural power, but because they are unthreatening and human, they are not so much awe-inspiring as charming. Most people try to please, but the pleasantness of the child comes effortlessly, defying logical explanation, and what is irrational is often dangerously seductive. More important, a child represents a world from which we have been forever exiled. Because adult life is full of boredom and compromise, we harbor an illusion of childhood as a kind of golden age, even though it can often be a period of great confusion and pain. It cannot be denied, however, that childhood had certain privileges, and as children we had a pleasurable attitude to life. Confronted with a particularly charming child, we often feel wistful. We remember our own golden past, the qualities we have lost and wish we had again. And in the presence of the child, we get a little of that goldenness back. Natural seducers are people who somehow avoided getting certain childish traits drummed out of them by adult experience. Such people can be as powerfully seductive as any child, because it seems uncanny and marvelous that they have preserved such qualities. They are not literally like children, of course. That would make them obnoxious or pitiful. Rather, it is the spirit that they have retained. Don't imagine that this childishness is something beyond their control. Natural seducers learn early on the value of retaining a particular quality and the seductive power it contains. They adapt and build upon those childlike traits that they managed to preserve, exactly as the child learns to play with its natural charm.
This is the key. It is within your power to do the same, since there is lurking within all of us a devilish child straining to be let loose. To do this successfully, you have to be able to let go to a degree, since there's nothing less natural than seeming hesitant. Remember the spirit you once had. Let it return without self-consciousness. People are much more forgiving of those who go all the way, who seem uncontrollably foolish, than the half-hearted adult with a childish streak. Remember who you were before you became so polite and self-effacing. To assume the role of the natural, mentally position yourself in any relationship as the child, the younger one. The following are the main types of the adult natural. Keep in mind that the greatest natural seducers are often a blend of more than one of these qualities. The innocent. The primary qualities of innocence are weakness and misunderstanding of the world. Innocence is weak because it is doomed to vanish in a harsh, cruel world. The child cannot protect or hold on to its innocence. The misunderstandings come from the child's not knowing about good and evil, and seeing everything through uncorrupted eyes. The weakness of children elicits sympathy. Their misunderstandings make us laugh, and nothing is more seductive than a mixture of laughter and sympathy. The adult natural is not truly innocent. It's impossible to grow up in this world and retain total innocence. Yet naturals yearn so deeply to hold on to their innocent outlook that they manage to preserve the illusion of innocence. They exaggerate their weakness to elicit the proper sympathy. They act like they still see the world through innocent eyes, which in an adult proves doubly humorous. Much of this is conscious, but to be effective, adult naturals must make it seem subtle and effortless. If they are seen as trying to act innocent, it will come across as pathetic. It's better for them to communicate weakness indirectly, through looks and glances, or through the situations they get themselves into, rather than anything obvious. Since this type of innocence is mostly an act, it's easily adaptable for your own purposes. Learn to play up any natural weaknesses or flaws. The imp. Impish children have a fearlessness that we adults have lost. That's because they don't see the possible consequences of their actions, how some people might be offended, how they might physically hurt themselves in the process. Imps are brazen, blissfully uncaring. They infect you with their light-hearted spirit. Such children have not yet had their natural energy and spirit scolded out of them by the need to be polite and civil. Secretly, we envy them. We want to be naughty too. Adult imps are seductive because of how different they are from the rest of us. Breaths of fresh air in a cautious world, they go full throttle as if their impishness were uncontrollable and thus natural. If you play the part, don't worry about offending people now and then. You're too lovable, and inevitably they will forgive you. Just don't apologize or look contrite, for that would break the spell. Whatever you say or do, keep a glint in your eye to show that you don't take anything seriously. The wonder. A wonder child has a special, inexplicable talent, a gift for music, for mathematics, for chess, for sport. At work in the field in which they have such prodigal skill, these children seem possessed and their actions effortless. If they're artists or musicians, Mozart types, their work seems to spring from some inborn impulse, requiring remarkably little thought. If it's a physical talent that they have, they are blessed with unusual energy, dexterity, and spontaneity. In both cases, they seem talented beyond their years. This fascinates us. Adult wonders are often former wonder children who have managed remarkably to retain their youthful impulsiveness and improvisational skills. True spontaneity is a delightful rarity, for everything in life conspires to rob us of it. We have to learn to act carefully and deliberately, to think about how we look in other people's eyes. To play the wonder, you need some skill that seems easy and natural, along with the ability to improvise.
If in fact your skill takes practice, you must hide this and learn to make your work appear effortless. The more you hide the sweat behind what you do, the more natural and seductive it will appear. The undefensive lover. As people get older, they protect themselves against painful experiences by closing themselves off. The price for this is that they grow rigid, physically and mentally. But children are by nature unprotected and open to experience, and this receptiveness is extremely attractive. In the presence of children, we become less rigid, infected with their openness. That is why we want to be around them. Undefensive lovers have somehow circumvented the self-protective process, retaining the playful, receptive spirit of the child. They often manifest this spirit physically. They are graceful and seem to age less rapidly than other people. Of all the natural's character qualities, this one is the most useful. Defensiveness is deadly in seduction. Act defensive, and you'll bring out defensiveness in other people. The undefensive lover, on the other hand, lowers the inhibitions of his or her target, a critical part of seduction. It's important to learn to not react defensively. Bend instead of resist. Be open to influence from others, and they will more easily fall under your spell. Examples of natural seducers. 1. As a child growing up in England, Charlie Chaplin spent years in dire poverty, particularly after his mother was committed to an asylum. In his early teens, forced to work to live, he landed a job in vaudeville, eventually gaining some success as a comedian. But Chaplin was wildly ambitious, and so in 1910, when he was only 19, he emigrated to the United States, hoping to break into the film business. Making his way to Hollywood, he found occasional bit parts, but success seemed elusive. Competition was fierce, and although Chaplin had a repertoire of gags that he'd learned in vaudeville, he didn't particularly excel at physical humor, a critical part of silent comedy. He wasn't a gymnast like Buster Keaton. In 1914, Chaplin managed to get the lead in a film short called Making a Living. His role was that of a con artist. In playing around with the costume for the part, he put on a pair of pants several sizes too large, then added a derby hat, enormous boots that he wore on the wrong feet, a walking cane, and a pasted-on mustache. With the clothes, a whole new character seemed to come to life, first the silly walk, then the twirling of the cane, then all sorts of gags. Mack Sennett, the head of the studio, didn't find Making a Living very funny, and doubted whether Chaplin had a future in the movies, but a few critics felt otherwise. A review in a trade magazine read, "The clever player who takes the role of a nervy and very nifty sharper in this picture is a comedian of the first water who acts like one of nature's own naturals." And audiences also responded. The film made money. What seemed to touch a nerve in Making a Living, setting Chaplin apart from the horde of other comedians working in silent film, was the almost pathetic naivete of the character he played. Sensing he was on to something, Chaplin shaped the role further in subsequent movies, rendering him more and more naive. The key was to make the character seem to see the world through the eyes of a child. In The Bank, he is the bank janitor who daydreams of great deeds while robbers are at work in the building. In The Pawnbroker, he is an unprepared shop assistant who wreaks havoc on a grandfather clock. In Shoulder Arms, he is a soldier in the bloody trenches of World War I, reacting to the horrors of war like an innocent child. Chaplin made sure to cast actors in his films who were physically larger than he was, subliminally positioning them as adult bullies and himself as the helpless infant. And as he went deeper into his character, something strange happened. The character and the real-life man began to merge. Although he had had a troubled childhood, he was obsessed with it, For his film Easy Street, he built a set in Hollywood that duplicated the London streets he had known as a boy. He mistrusted the adult world, preferring the company of the young, or the young at heart. Three of his four wives were teenagers when he married them. More than any other comedian, Chaplin aroused a mix of laughter and sentiment. He made you empathize with him as the victim, feel sorry for him the way you would for a lost dog. You both laughed and cried, and audiences sensed that the role Chaplin played came from somewhere deep inside, that he was sincere, that he was actually playing himself. Within a few years after Making a Living, Chaplin was the most famous actor in the world. There were Chaplin dolls, comic books, toys. Popular songs and short stories were written about him. He became a universal icon. In 1921, when he returned to London for the first time since he'd left it, he was greeted by enormous crowds, as if at the triumphant return of a great general. The greatest seducers, those who seduce mass audiences, nations, the world, have a way of playing on people's unconscious, making them react in a way they can neither understand nor control. Chaplin inadvertently hit on this power when he discovered the effect he could have on audiences by playing up his weakness, by suggesting that he had a child's mind in an adult body. In the early 20th century, the world was radically and rapidly changing. People were working longer and longer hours at increasingly mechanical jobs. Life was becoming steadily more inhuman and heartless, as the ravages of World War I made clear. Caught in the midst of revolutionary change, people yearned for a lost childhood that they imagined as a golden paradise. An adult child like Chaplin has immense seductive power, for he offers the illusion that life was once simpler and easier, and that for a moment, or for as long as the movie lasts, you can win that life back. In a cruel, amoral world, naivete has enormous appeal. The key is to bring it off with an air of total seriousness, as the straight man does in stand-up comedy. More important, however, is the creation of sympathy. Overt strength and power is rarely seductive. It makes us afraid or envious. The royal road to seduction is to play up your vulnerability and helplessness. You cannot make this obvious. To seem to be begging for sympathy is to seem needy, which is entirely anti-seductive. Do not proclaim yourself a victim or underdog, but reveal it in your manner, in your confusion. A display of natural weakness will make you instantly lovable, both lowering people's defenses and making them feel delightfully superior to you. Put yourself in situations that make you seem weak, in which someone else has the advantage. They are the bully. You are the innocent lamb. Without any effort on your part, people will feel sympathy for you. Once people's eyes cloud over with sentimental mist, they will not see how you are manipulating them. 2. Emma Crouch, born in 1842 in Plymouth, England, came from a respectable middle-class family. Her father was a composer and music professor who dreamed of success in the world of light opera. Among his many children, Emma was his favorite. She was a delightful child, lively and flirtatious, with red hair and a freckled face. Her father doted on her and promised her a brilliant future in the theater. Unfortunately, Mr. Crouch had a dark side. He was an adventurer, a gambler, and a rake, and in 1849 he abandoned his family and left for America. The Crouches were now in dire straits. Emma was told that her father had died in an accident and she was sent off to a convent. The loss of her father affected her deeply, and as the years went by, she seemed lost in the past, acting as if he still doted on her. One day in 1856, when Emma was walking home from church, a well-dressed gentleman invited her home for some cakes. She followed him to his house, where he proceeded to take advantage of her.
The next morning, this man, a diamond merchant, promised to set her up in a house of her own, treat her well, and give her plenty of money. She took the money, but left him, determined to do what she had always wanted, never see her family again, never depend on anyone, and lead the grand life that her father had promised her. With the money the diamond merchant had given her, Emma bought nice clothes and rented a cheap flat. Adopting the flamboyant name of Cora Pearl, she began to frequent London's Argyle Rooms, a fancy gin palace where harlots and gentlemen rubbed elbows. The proprietor of the Argyle, a Mr. Bignall, took note of this newcomer to his establishment. She was so brazen for a young girl. At 45, he was much older than she was, but he decided to be her lover and protector, lavishing her with money and attention. The following year, he took her to Paris, which was at the height of its Second Empire prosperity. Cora was enthralled by Paris and of all its sights, but what impressed her the most was the parade of rich coaches in the Bois de Boulogne. Here, the fashionable came to take the air, the empress, the princesses, and not least the grand courtesans, who had the most opulent carriages of all. This was the way to lead the kind of life Cora's father had wanted for her. She promptly told Bignall that when he went back to London, she would stay on alone. Frequenting all the right places, Cora soon came to the attention of wealthy French gentlemen. They would see her walking the streets in a bright pink dress to complement her flaming red hair, pale face, and freckles. They would glimpse her riding wildly through the Bois de Boulogne, cracking her whip left and right. They would see her in cafes, surrounded by men, her witty insults making them laugh. They also heard of her exploits, of her delight in showing her body to one and all. The elite of Paris society began to court her, particularly the older men who had grown tired of the cold and calculating courtesans, and who admired her girlish spirit. As money began to pour in from her various conquests, the Duc de Mornay, heir to the Dutch throne, Prince Napoleon, cousin to the Emperor, Cora spent it on the most outrageous things, a multicolored carriage pulled by a team of cream-colored horses, a rose marble bathtub with her initials inlaid in gold. Gentlemen vied to be the one who would spoil her the most. An Irish lover wasted his entire fortune on her in only 8 weeks. But money couldn't buy Cora's loyalty. She would leave a man on the slightest whim. Cora Pearl's wild behavior and disdain for etiquette had all of Paris on edge. In 1864, she was to appear as Cupid in the Offenbach operetta, Orpheus in the Underworld. Society was dying to see what she would do to cause a sensation, and soon found out. She came on stage practically naked, except for expensive diamonds here and there, barely covering her. As she pranced on stage, the diamonds fell off, each one worth a fortune. She didn't stoop to pick them up, but let them roll off into the footlights. The gentlemen in the audience, some of whom had given her those diamonds, applauded her wildly. Antics like this made Cora the toast of Paris, and she reigned as the city's supreme courtesan for over a decade, until the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 put an end to the Second Empire. People often mistakenly believe that what makes a person desirable and seductive is physical beauty, elegance, or overt sexuality. Yet Cora Pearl was not dramatically beautiful. Her body was boyish, and her style was garish and tasteless. Even so, the most dashing men of Europe vied for her favors, often ruining themselves in the process. It was Cora's spirit and attitude that enthralled them. Spoiled by her father, she imagined that spoiling her was natural, that all men should do the same. The consequence was that, like a child, she never felt she had to try to please. It was Cora's powerful air of independence that made men want to possess her, tame her. She never pretended to be anything more than a courtesan,
So the brazenness that in a lady would have been uncivil, in her seemed natural and fun. And as with a spoiled child, a man's relationship with her was on her terms. The moment he tried to change that, she lost interest. This was the secret of her astounding success. Spoiled children have an undeservedly bad reputation.